You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to Brookings. My name is Ron Hanskins. I'm a senior fellow here, and along with my colleague, Belle Sawhill, whom you'll meet in a few minutes, we run an organization here called the Center on Children and Families. And part of the Center on Children and Families is a project called Budgeting for National Priorities. And for a long time, 7 years, I think, we have been trying to sound the alarm that the nation has a deficit and we ought to do something about it. And we've participated in several activities, one of which we call our fiscal seminar, the Heritage Brookings Fiscal Seminar. It's 16 people with a lot of experience in Washington, Washington insiders, if they referred to them in the Post. And for quite some time now, we've been very interested in premium support. Here's why. Let me put two facts on the table that I think everybody in the room accepts, and we'll all start with a common understanding, which is, number one, America's going bankrupt, and number two, health spending is a big part of our problems with financing. So if we're going to do something about America's deficit, we have to do something about health care and, in particular, Medicare and Medicaid. And so this idea of premium support has come to the top. It's gotten a lot of attention in the last several years, and attention was boosted yesterday, as I'm sure we'll get into before this event is over, because Ron Wyden and Paul Ryan agreed to something like a plan. There seems to be some debate about exactly what it is that they've agreed to. And the answer is you never know until you see legislation. And he specifically said we're not going to draft a bill. So there will be lots of questions, I'm sure. So because we're interested in premium support, and it seems to be a potential way to reduce medical spending in general in the United States, including Medicare and Medicaid, our fiscal seminar has pursued this. We wrote a paper. We got the best critics and the best supporters to write parts of the paper, and it's very clearly distinguished who agrees and who doesn't. And we're following exactly the same format in this meeting this morning that will begin with the specific plan, which is also outlined as the final part of our paper and is available to everybody here and will also be available on the web. And it's, of course, we're totally unbiased in our selection of the Rivlin-Domenici plan. You know, you wouldn't think that we'd be, by such a coincidence, have a person from Brookings that sponsors the plan, but there it is. So we're going to start with them describing their plan. Then I'm going to ask them a couple questions. We're going to give you a chance to ask them a couple of questions. And then we're going to have a panel. And as in the paper, the panels have to divide it between people who support and people who don't. So you're going to get all the sides. It's not Brookings or our Budgeting for National Priorities place to lobby for anything, but we are attempting to improve the understanding of the public and of scholars and of people who are interested in health policy and in the budget deficit. And in our wildest imagination, we might even think that we could improve the understanding of policymakers. Wouldn't that be good? So then, let's begin. Let me say just a few brief words about our first two participants. Senator Domenici, of course, is well known. He's had a long and distinguished career, especially focused on budget issues. He was a wonderful chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. And when he left Congress, he, along with others, started the Bipartisan Policy Center, and he's now a senior fellow there. And last year, as many of you know, Senator Domenici, along with Alice Rivlin, authored a very good plan to address the whole budget, not just health care, but the entire budget. It's gotten a lot of attention. So Alice and Senator Domenici are used to working together. And then, of course, we have Alice Rivlin, a senior fellow here at Brookings. Alice has had some experience in these matters. Alice was the head of the Congressional Budget Office. She was the first head of the Congressional Budget Office. She also was the head of the Office of Management and Budget. She has been on the Federal Reserve Board, and some of you may remember that back in the day, she literally rescued the District of Columbia from the exact same budget fate that we appear to be facing now as a nation, and that plan actually worked, and ever since, the budget, the district has had has lived within their budget. So that is an amazing accomplishment. So we have a great first panel, and I believe Senator Domenici is going to speak first. So, Senator?
Thank you very much. First, excuse my voice. As I was joking with my friends, I said I went to the doctor to get cured from a little tiny noise that was in my throat, and he put something down there and looked around with a light and told me that my voice box was not quite working properly, and he sent me home he'll send me a note with somebody who might help me. And the next day I woke up like this, and I can't get in to see the doctor, so it was a strange visit. Instead of helping, everything's gotten worse. But anyway, let's hope it'll come out all right. First, I want to say to the Brookings organizers, for Pete Domenici to be party to this, this is the worst setting you could have, because I usually have things about here. Now I don't know how to read my speech. I have new glasses, and they're terrific. Cataracts have been removed. I'm getting so old. I'm really burdening that Medicare system with costs, I tell you. I know what it costs to be old and sick, because I see those bills that Medicare gets. But I would like to tell you that the first thing that happened, we had the super committee appointed with all the super men on it, men and women, and they set about in a boat to rescue the ship of state. And after all the time they had, they didn't solve anything, and the boat was floundering out there, and they jumped overboard, and each one still had had real firm on the back and life preserver that said, I'm a D, had a D for a Democrat and R for the Republican on their safety. And they paddled to shore, and the ship of state went out a little bit and then sunk. And you know why I use it is because truly what happened is that those people weren't able to abandon their partisan ness on taxes and on entitlements. They couldn't get rid of the thing that was on their back for R&D. And that's what happened to America. The best chance to solve the problems went down in that boat. So let me start by saying the problems, while both parties may have come away unscathed from that one, America's economic and fiscal woes have not disappeared. They didn't go down with the ship. The economy is still sluggish, and the central drivers of our debt went untouched. And Medicare and tax reform remain the cornerstones, without any doubt. They are the cornerstones of fiscal reform. The plan that you're going to hear about today, which is called Domenici Rivlin, but to tell you the truth, it should probably be more Rivlin Domenici, because I'm not an expert at all, and Alice keeps claiming she's not an expert, and she knows 10 times more than I, so that tells you where each of us are. But
don't you believe
it's fundamentally Medicare reform has to take place, and the costs that are currently being produced by Medicare have to be changed. And I'll stop just for a moment here and have you all look at this chart. It is very easy now for anyone that knows this budget to say, if you have a plan and it has not produced revenues, and presumably produced revenues and made us more competitive at the same time in the tax reform, and if you haven't solved some of the problems of health care led by Medicare, then you don't have a plan. And if you look up there at that one I put up for you, look at that blue line. That blue line is a graph of graphed upward health care spending versus a percent of the GDP. And we're measuring everything by a percent of GDP now. And look at that one. It looks like Social Security is there, but it's not going to break this problem because the percent of GDP doesn't change much, and neither does defense and domestic. And then go down and have all the other mandatory programs and look at the one that's making the wrong kind of headway. And it's this health care spending. It's going along that blue line. And unless you have a program that somewhere along the line, somewhere from 7 to 20 years, doesn't bend that curve, then you don't have anything that's going to help America out of the mess we're in, out of the problem we're in. So the country has been presented with Simpson-Bowles, which is a good plan. It didn't have as much in it as we have in ours on Medicare. But it was a good plan on two-thirds of the budget. We had the other third in Medicare, and we're not embarrassed to tell you that we believe ours will work, and there will have to be a change from the regulate everything and it will work to a you can continue to regulate Medicare, but you've got to have something new for the new program, and it would be competition, exchanges that will exist in the regions that will bring competition into the program with a cap, and that will be explained more by Alice as she talks about it. But it seems to me quite clear that a new approach is necessary. There are those who say, let's just wait and rely upon the giant Obama health care program that's rocking along. We believe we have to find something new, what we have is new in the sense that we are promoting it and we put it together in a way that can be enforced, can be put on the table. But it's also quite obvious that there is a chance, some say a 50-50 or better chance, that the Obama health care plan will be declared unconstitutional. In either event, we are moving along with ours, and it is a regulatory, it is not a regulatory scheme, it is a competitive scheme that would come into effect at a time certain. We do make sure that in this competitive program that those who are poor and if they need money to help pay for their premium support, we provide for that in our proposal. Those who are not able to pay, they get a bonus, and that's for the first time we worked hard at figuring out how to do that, and we think we've done that quite well in this bill. So I want to say there are those who will say without question that our proposal is not necessary. Things are working very well with the implementation of the super bill, the Obama health care package. Let it run its course. We say it's probably going to work if regulation works. But we think regulation hasn't worked in the past. We've got super inflation in spite of regulation, and we ought to have this approach that we've put forth for you, and therefore those who want to choose it. In the end, Medicare will not be taken off the table. It will still be there for those who want it. There will be a new program there for those who want it, and we think the combination of the two is the best thing America could do. So with that, I would yield to my colleague and say, please put this together so they'll understand something instead of having to rely on me. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Pete. Why are we talking about Medicare reform? Why especially is the Center on Children and Families talking about Medicare reform? And as Ron pointed out, this is in the context of our enormous fear that the fiscal situation of the United States is unsustainable. We face a problem that threatens our economy, and we have to do something about it. Our debt is rising faster than our economy can grow. And stabilizing the debt, our bipartisan commission found, Simpson-Bowles found, requires really two major things. One is slowing the growth of health care spending, especially Medicare. Be nice to fix Social Security, too. The other is raising more revenue from a simpler, fairer tax system. Nobody we know wants to get rid of Medicare. Medicare serves a growing older population. It's an essential program. We can't do without it. We need to preserve it for the future. And as you look down the road, Medicare is not in good shape. It is the growth of Medicare is unsustainable in the long run, partly because the current Medicare system, fee-for-service Medicare, does not reward cost saving or improvements in outcomes. It encourages higher volume of services without looking at what you actually get for it. So what to do about that? There are basically two approaches. One is a regulatory approach, improving the efficiency and effectiveness of Medicare over time. The other is a competitive approach, letting alternative plans compete for Medicare beneficiaries. We're for both. And this plan, we believe, put together by a bipartisan group, should appeal to both Republicans and Democrats. On making existing Medicare more efficient, we need to discourage higher costs. There are huge differences between different parts of the country in the cost of delivering the same services to the same patients with the same diagnosis. We need to figure out why that is true adopt in Medicare the most cost-effective approaches to treating older people with, as Pete pointed out, and as I know too, there are multiple problems. So in the Affordable Care Act, we have a whole bunch of institutions, the pilot programs, innovative centers, the Independent Payments Advisory Board, that are directed to sift through the best knowledge that can be accumulated and get Medicare working more effectively and efficiently to hold down the increase in costs. And we're enthusiastic about that general approach. The other approach is competition. Let plans that will provide the same benefits compete in a way that incents them be more cost effective and to offer better services at lower cost. So we are advocating that we move Medicare in that direction as well. So what would this plan do? We would preserve fee-for-service traditional Medicare, not temporarily, but permanently. If you want to be in that, you can stay in it. But we would provide the option of going to an exchange, a federally run exchange, but we would set them up regionally, meaning metropolitan areas and major rural areas would have separate exchanges. Plans would compete on those exchanges. They would have to offer the same benefits, at least the same benefits as Medicare on an actuarial basis. They would be subject to the rules that they had to accept anybody who applied. The plan would be compensated on a risk-adjusted basis, more if you were older or sicker. And it would be a regulated exchange on which you couldn't cheat by attracting the youngest and the healthiest patients in any way. You'd have to play by the rules, and you would be thrown off the exchange if you didn't. The government's contribution would be determined by bidding on the exchanges, in which the fee-for-service Medicare would also be a competitor. The government's contribution would be the second lowest bid. And we believe that the competition would, over time, result in more cost effectiveness, and that fee-for-service Medicare, if it improved as much as the regulator's approach hopes, might well be the best plan in some parts of the country, maybe many parts of the country. But we have a fail-safe mechanism on the government's contribution. If the government's contribution determined by the bidding process were to rise cumulatively over time faster than the economy was growing plus 1%, it would be capped at that point, and the excess would result in a means-tested premium, we would protect the low end of the distribution, but people with higher incomes would have to pay more. It is in that sense a defined contribution plan, so that the Congress and the country would know how much the maximum that Medicare would cost, and incidentally, that would make it scorable by our friends at CBO. If it turned out that a lot of cost was being shifted to seniors, and the Congress wanted to change the law, obviously they could. They could change the premium, take more out of providers. They could do anything they want. Congress can always change the law, but it would have to do it by legislation. As Ron mentioned yesterday, Senator Wyden and Chairman Ryan came out with a plan which is quite similar. I think it's very exciting that a senior Democrat and a not-so-senior but emerging leader on the Republican side have come together around a plan. We're going to need the solutions to be bipartisan, and here is a step in that direction, and we applaud it. There is clearly no perfect answer to how to control health care costs best or how to reform Medicare best. But we think we have a compromise plan that should appeal to the hopes of those who want to reform Medicare largely by regulation, implementing best practice and so forth, and those who believe in competition. This is a plan that puts together both of those things. Thank you.
Might I say before you move on, it will be said today that we don't have any proof that this would work, what Alice has just explained, that you could keep Medicare, but you would have another approach available, which she has described as competitive and regional. It seems to me that the problem that we have in this country is big enough in health care and its rising costs that we ought to try something different, but at the same time not do it foolishly. If you keep Medicare and try something new, then obviously it will never be any worse than Medicare is, because the approach is, would you like to have something else because it either provides better services or the price is better? And we don't have to be total capitalists on the issue. I am a capitalist. I am worried about America not being as free enterprise oriented as we were 15 years ago. But I don't think we're risking anything here, and we do have an approach that relies on something that has been very good for America, and that is competition between A and B to provide or sell something. So long as we have the last word up here as Congress people, and we'll leave that alone for a while. Actually, ours is a long-term solution. It's not next day or next week. It's long-term. I believe it's worth looking at. And I want to close by saying you can't do better than have the two, one Democrat, one Republican, led by a chairman of the Budget Committee in the House, which has a commanding majority now. I don't know what they'll have in a while. And Senator Wyden, who has been known in healthcare to be an innovator, to have the two of them working in the area that we are and coming up with something similar is, to me, very gratifying, and it shows that hard work that we did and others did might prove beneficial to America's fiscal policy and our sick seniors as they pass through the system. Thank you again.
Thank you. So when we look back at all the way back to when we first started our budgeting for national priorities,
And now we look at the 7 years or so that's happened. There have already been some major events in this development, because when we started, hardly anybody was even paying attention. So a lot has happened.
Now they've noticed.
Now they've noticed. Okay. I think we're going to look back at the Wyden-Ryan proposal as a crucial turning point in the event. First, do you agree with that? And then second, I think it would be very helpful and important in how, in judging how important their plan is. You went over very quickly the differences between their approach and your approach. I think it would be good to give the audience at least a feeling for how similar or dissimilar the plans are.
As I read the Ryan, the Wyden-Ryan plan, it is very similar to ours. Some of the language is a little unclear, as is often true on Capitol Hill, and they haven't written a bill. There are a couple of obvious differences. One is they start later. They don't start until 2022, which means that anybody who is 55 or older is not affected in any way, and they wanted to make that point. We thought starting a little sooner would be a good idea because, after all, it gives seniors a choice. So
that's right.
Why not give them the choice sooner? I think that's the main.
And we keep Medicare while that choice is being offered.
Yeah, you bet. I think that's the main difference. Wyden-Ryan also has a kind of appendage about small businesses, employees of small businesses being allowed to take their employer contribution in cash. But that has nothing to do with Medicare. That's just tacked on. And I'm not clear that there are other differences.
What about exchanges? It's
hard to say exactly what they are doing. They talk about competition and federal regulation of competition. They don't exactly say exchanges. We are more specific about that because we have a vision of exchanges set up around the country under CMS rules.
Let me say exchanges, it's interesting to note that under the president's health care plan, there are exchanges being developed
right.
also. So it's not
right.
like we're the only ones that are to trust the market. They want to trust it in part of the delivery system, not in total, but they do. It does there also, right?
Indeed, from a long-run perspective, if you do believe that the exchanges under the Affordable Care Act will work, and I think there's good hope of that, then you would have a population of people retiring who were used to exchanges and used to choices, and you would have plans that were used to offering a plan on a state exchange, and they would want to keep their members in the same plan as they transition to Medicare. But that's a long way from now.
As our fiscal seminar these last several months went through this process, we heard a lot about the problems with premium support, and there's a very powerful summary of those problems and exploration of the problems in the paper written by Henry Aaron, whom you'll hear from in just a minute. And having gone through those, the one that I think really resonates and something that has to be addressed is that the elderly already pay something like 16% of their income for various out-of-pocket expenses for health care. And under your plan, any premium support plan, there's some risk that if the competition and the regulation from the president's bill and so forth does not control health care costs, that some of the burden could fall on recipients. How do you respond to that when people bring that up as a criticism?
Yes, there is some risk. The alternative to that is saying none of it will ever fall on recipients, even high-income recipients. It will all fall on providers. That is basically what the Affordable Care Act seems to say, because it does have the same cap in it. It isn't exactly a cap, but the same goal for controlling Medicare costs, but enforced by keeping provider payments down. Not clear to me that that's absolutely the right way to go.
Mm-hmm. And in your...
Could I say... Yeah. Look, this whole problem that we're having in your seminars are dealing with in terms of fiscal responsibility, it's filled with risks. I mean, there's a risk that we're going to go bankrupt if we don't fix Medicare.
Yeah, right.
There's no doubt about it. The seniors in this country want America to succeed. They don't like what they feel about America in the doldrums, and we can't do anything. And there is a risk that our providers won't be receiving enough money, and we won't get the kind of medical skills applied to keeping seniors healthy. So we have to build a system that provides that the risk is shared. We want the providers to be paid well so we will grow and have the best in the world for our people. But there's no assurance that's going to happen unless we have a well-defined system. The costs are not going to shift on the seniors in any unreasonable manner. Nobody's going to sit around and let that happen. As you look at the cap, they're going to do something if that happens. So it seems to me what's going to happen is people are going to take our plan and go out to the public and say, no, it's no good because seniors might have to pay more, so throw it away. Well, the truth of the matter is everybody might have to pay more, and we might have to have taxes too. Here's a Republican who's chairman of the Budget Committee says, fix health care and save money, and if that is not enough to fix our fiscal policy, go ahead and raise revenue. I have said that. But you've got to do both. You can't just do one.
In addition, isn't it too true that under your plan that there would be some protection for low-income elders?
Absolutely.
I think that's
in that's in Wyden, Ryan.
Yeah. So that's an important point, that the criticism is somewhat addressed by protecting low-income elderly.
Yes, but the bottom line, as the senator has said, is the status quo is not an option, and costs are going to have to be restrained, and if they're not, they're shifted somewhere.
Audience, please stand up, bring a microphone, say your name, and ask a question, not a long comment. We've gone to get in as many questions as we can, so let's go right to your right. Yeah, right here.
Chris Fleming from Health Affairs Blog. I wonder if you see the history of Medicare Plus Choice as a little bit of a concern in terms of your plan. I mean, that program started out with a lot of the same goals for competition. Private plans were going to be paid less than fee-for-service and drive costs down through that competition. And over time, we ended up with a situation where until recently, through lobbying and other means, the private plans were being paid, I think, something like 118% of fee-for-service. Do you worry that similar things might happen to your plan going forward?
Good question.
So I started on that. Yes, certainly the history of Medicare Plus Choice or Medicare Advantage is, on the one hand, it's gotten, the competition has gotten better, and it's working, the competition in Medicare Advantage is working quite well in some places, but it wasn't set up right, we think. And there isn't an incentive to pick a more cost-effective plan because it would save you, the beneficiary, money. The incentive is you might get more services, and you do. So we would change the way the competition is set up quite radically.
Where's our expert on that? Is he here? The man that helped us. We were at a point and said, let's fix this.
Yeah, Paul Ginsberg helped us with this and might want to say a word about it.
I would say the big difference is that by organizing private plans on an exchange, I think that you can get a much more competitive environment. Actually, I think the way the current political system is, the chance that private plans would be able to lobby to get more than traditional Medicare is very slim. In fact, I think that the details of this plan actually make it virtually impossible, because there is this very specific process that determines the federal contribution for persons' benefits, whether they're enrolled in traditional Medicare or a private plan.
Paul, thank you. Next question. Behind you on the right, on your left now, if you're...
Can you help us with this answer?
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I applaud you. It seems to be going in an excellent direction. But any session I go to like this that discusses healthcare manpower says we need a lot more healthcare manpower. How are you going to control prices and increase the manpower?
I think we need different kinds of health manpower, and that a competitive system is likely to incent that. If you look at the difference between us and other countries that have other advanced countries that have healthcare systems that deliver good health care for less money or less percentage of their GDP, one of the big differences is they use more primary care and fewer specialists, and they don't therefore don't pay their docs as much. Comprehensive plans that agree to treat you for what ails you tend to move in that direction faster than a fee-for-service system.
All right, let's take two questions, and then we'll you have a choice of what you answer. Go, here on your right, down, yes.
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Pomplin. I'm a primary care physician. What does your plan do about, for example, the Mayo Clinic just bought two machines to do proton beam therapy for prostate cancer at $70,000 a pop. That's a treatment. The machines are terribly expensive. Well, now that Mayo has two of them, they're going to run them all the time. Are you going to have the insurance company say, well, your plan just doesn't cover this? You need to get to Mayo before it buys the machines. Once it buys the machines, it has to run lots of people through them.
Another question. Yes. Right down that, yes.
Hi. Diana Meredith from the House Budget Committee. I want to ask about risk adjustment. Everything I've read about these premium support proposals basically asserts that we will have some sort of perfect risk adjustment system that will control for all the cherry picking that might otherwise occur. But everything I know about Medicare Advantage is that anything we do to address risk selection, they find ways to game it. So I would like to know, are there examples out there in the world of really well-functioning risk adjustment that give you confidence that you can design a system that doesn't result in a death spiral for traditional Medicare?
Risk adjustment, we never said we had a perfect way of doing risk adjustment. Risk adjustment is difficult. Experience has been improving, and plans are doing it better than they used to. I think the way, as Paul said earlier, the way we would set up the exchanges would make it very difficult for plans to cherry pick. They would have to take everybody. They would be prohibited from doing cherry picking, and that would be enforced. I mean, you have to have an enforcement mechanism. The Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan does police what the plans are doing, and you have to do that. As to very high cost treatments, those are going to be a problem in the future As Henry Aaron has pointed out in a book some years ago, at some point we're going to get to rationing. I think our point is we're not there yet, there's a lot that can be saved by doing things more cost-effectively in the interim, so let's do it.
Could I comment on the question on somebody asked about training enough people, training enough people in various expertise in health delivery. We don't have anything on that in our bill, but obviously the country has to be concerned about the adequacy of general practitioners and the like, and something has to be done, not by way of the government taking over and deciding who's going to do what, but certainly we have to find a way to help fill those gap areas where there's more demand than we have professionals to fit the demand. And there's no question we have some of those in our system, and it's not resulting in just better service. In some instances, the doctors are getting the short end of the stick, and they don't take on more patients and don't fulfill their desires to the fullest. I want to make a comment for fear that I won't get a chance. In working on this problem, I have, as an individual citizen, had the opportunity because of things happening to me that required medical care to meet perhaps 40 or 50 people involved in the delivery of health care, from the very best surgeon to that person that helps you get dressed if you're feeling bad. And actually, there is a tremendous positive attitude among those that are delivering health care, especially those that are graduates of our medical schools. That they have gone through an experience that makes them kind of automatically knowledgeable, but they are extremely aware of the patient and of what they're doing for, what are they doing the right thing for to help society and help people get well. And I think that bodes well in terms of the answer to your question. I think our American people want to be part of a good health delivery system. And if they're part of the actors, I think chance of our kind of approach working fiscally and stabilizing things will do a lot to putting people in the right niche as they choose to serve their fellow Americans with health care.
Please join me in thanking the members of the panel. And stay in your seats. We're going to get the next panel up here very quickly.